Good morning. This is Carol Ventura, Executive Director of Rhode Island Housing. This is the February 8th, 2023 in-person meeting of the Rhode Island Housing Board of Commissioners Credit Committee. This meeting is also being made available via live teleconference for public access. CJ Rotella, Director of Information Technology for Rhode Island Housing, will provide information on this combined in-person and telephonic meeting.
Good morning, this is CJ Rotella. This meeting will be recorded and available for your review on Rhode Island Housing's website within 3 to 5 business days after this meeting. Except for specific Rhode Island Housing staff, all callers will be muted during the meeting. To prevent any feedback or background noise, we ask participants to please mute your telephone if you are not speaking. If during the meeting anyone is having technical difficulties with the audio or accessing the call, they should call 401-457-1240. Thank you.
Thank you, CJ. This is Carol Ventura. Corinne Myers, General Counsel for Rhode Island Housing, will provide additional information on this.
Good morning. This is Corinne Myers, General Counsel. Members of the public can visit the RA Housing website to view today's agenda and information on the actions being taken. If the teleconference is interrupted, we will stop the meeting until audio can be restored. Chairman of the Credit Committee, Kevin Orth, will preside at this morning's meeting. Commissioners and staff, please do state your name prior to speaking each and every time. And with that, I'll turn it over to Committee Chairman Orth to call the meeting to order.
Great. Thank you, Corinne. This is Kevin Orth. I'd like to call the meeting to order. It is 9:32, and Carol, please conduct an attendance.
Yes. Committee Chairman Orth.
Here.
Commissioner Sarah Cabral.
Yes.
Great. Thanks, Carol. We will go on to Agenda Item 1, which is approval of the minutes of the Credit Committee meeting held on December 7th, 2022. You get a motion, and I will second that. And do you want to conduct a vote, or?
As you like. All those in favor of recommending approval of the minutes of the Credit Committee meeting held on December 7th, 2022, please say aye.
Aye. Great, thank you. We'll go on to Agenda Item 2, which is recommendation for approval of reservation of low-income housing tax credits and firm approval of financing for West House 2, located in Middletown. And Stephanie, great, we'll be presenting. Thank you, Stephanie.
Good morning. Stephanie, we're here to present West House 2, located in Middletown. West House 2 is a 54-unit addition to the existing West House 1, which consists of 50 affordable, age-restricted, supportive housing units. Like West House 1, West House 2 will also be affordable, age-restricted housing. The developer is Church Community Housing Corporation. We are requesting firm approval of the reservation of 2022-2023 low-income housing tax credits up to $1,190,000. Approval of a taxable leasehold first mortgage in an amount of $2,480,000, a home loan in an amount up to $994,784, and RI rebound production funds in the amount of $1 million for West House 2. The development received preliminary approval from the Board of Commissioners on April 21st, 2022, and preliminary approval for RI rebounds on June 16th, 2022. West House 2 will enter a 99-year ground lease with West House 1 owner. The development will be designed to meet passive house certification and will include a solar array on the roof. Of the 54 units, 6 one-bedroom units will be available to households earning 30% of AMI and will be subsidized with HUD Section 811 vouchers. The remaining 34 one-bedroom units and 14 two-bedroom units will be available to households earning 60% of AMI. Since preliminary approval, there has been an increase in the budget of $1.1 million, primarily due to the increase in construction costs, financing costs, and land preparation required as a condition of partial land release from HUD. During preliminary, West House 2 was underwritten with an additional contingency of $1.2 million for cost escalation due to the volatility in the market and construction costs. With that, West House 2 was able to maintain a balanced budget by reallocating resources from preliminary approval and increasing rents. The rent increase, although conservative and below maximum rents, allowed the project to afford additional permanent debt, eliminating the need for a request for additional funding to fill the gap. Although costs have increased since preliminary approval, the cost per unit is $310,453 net reserves, which is far below the $390,000 cap per unit in the 2022 CRP. This indicator is National Equity Fund, and Webster Bank is a construction lender. Happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thanks so much, Beth. I appreciate it. I have a motion to approve.
I make a motion.
Okay, great. Thanks, Chair. I'll second that one. Do you have any questions about this?
I did have one question. So in the write-up, it said that most of the common areas are shared, and I don't know if I missed it, and I think you may have put it in, but parking is already completely abundant,
yes,
or is entirely doubling the size of.
Yes, it is. The site is actually in an office park,
okay,
so there's quite a bit of parking already.
That is
most
just dedicated to that,
yes,
those units.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
And then you had also mentioned that is it awaiting approval for the HUD release? Or
it has been granted approval of the partial release.
Okay. That was it.
Great. Question for Kara, actually. I'm glad you're here. I see that the notes indicate the permanent loan will be funded through FFB Risk Share.
Yes.
Which will be a little unusual, right, since it's a new construction. And just wondered how you were able to structure that.
Yeah. So when we're quoting the rates, we let them know that there's, you know, potential volatility. So we will add on a certain spread to that. When they finally finish construction, FFB right now doesn't allow for the construction portion, so it's just the permanent.
So who's taking on the interest rate risk then?
The developer.
Okay. So we just built in a cushion in that rate, so like, okay.
Yeah, that way the underwriting can still reflect, you know.
Okay. Okay. So we didn't hedge it or anything.
No, because it's not a firm.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a firm rate.
I will say one thing: the existing underwriting, there is a lot of room in the debt service
coverage.
So it's clearly a risk.
Mm-hmm.
We also withheld, you know, we always hold back a certain amount of the developer fee. So I think it's a calculated risk.
Okay. No, I think this is great. I mean, this is.
You have to get creative.
We have,
yeah,
to get creative. This is a. I don't know if it's the first time doing this with FFB, but it's got to be.
It'll be the second time, but yes, it's.
Okay.
Unusual. Right.
Okay.
And you know, we'll put the appropriate language in the loan agreement, which says that it, you know, we'll have to sort of reevaluate the debt at the time that the rate is set, because under FFB, you cannot lock the rate until 60 days before you're going to close.
Yeah. Okay. Another question was, a comment, and good job to this developer in holding cost increase to under 10% over this last year. And then a question, I got to qualify it, because the developer fee, it's relatively low as a percentage of the overall construction costs. However, we're putting in a ton of soft money, well, not a ton, but a fair amount of soft money, and there's minimal deferred fee here. So I'm wondering, and it looks like there must be cash flow to support more deferred fee if they're at a 125 debt cover. So I'm wondering a couple of things, I guess. Should we look at maybe allowing more developer fee on these deals so we can have more go into basis, but then maybe also deferring a larger portion of it?
Then the syndicator will look at that too, how much is being deferred and how much can be repaid.
Oh, I know, but typically they allow up to 50%, and we're doing 7% or something here.
Yeah. I mean, what I would say is actually this year for the 2023 round, we actually did increase developer fees. We for new construction, we do it based on the size of the unit. So it's very easy to calculate. You know, when they submitted their original proposal and then the supplemental proposal in March for the rebounds, I don't recall there ever being a deferred fee in this deal.
I don't think so.
And, you know, we knew that, you know, they had, and I think it's a testament to the fact that they were able to control their costs and they didn't have to. Not, you know, you'll see in the next action there's a deferred fee of nearly $500,000 as part of sort of the way to gap fill.
Right. I get it. I just conceptually, I think if we're going to be putting in a lot of soft money, everybody, it means there's a gap. So everybody should share filling in that gap, including the developer. With, again, the caveat that their developer isn't too large to begin with, but I'd like to maybe look at that.
We can meet internally.
Yeah.
And have a discussion around whether or not there shouldn't be a policy.
Okay. I think this is
happy
a great transaction. I think this is fantastic. I really like it. I think it utilizes existing infrastructure to keep the cost down. I mean, you can save on staffing that way through the economies of scale. They've done a great job carrying this forward. So I don't have any other questions. Do I ask for the vote or friends? Do you?
As you like. Do I make a motion?
Okay, all those in favor, aye?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. That's, all right, thank you very much. Let's move on to agenda item 3, which is recommendation for approval of reservation of low-income housing tax credits and firm approval of financing for Frenchtown Road 1 and 2, which is located in East Greenwich. And Stephanie, you're going to be presenting again. Thank you.
I am. Good morning. Stephanie Booker here to present Frenchtown Road Apartments for firm commitment. Frenchtown 1 and 2 is a proposed 63-unit mixed-income development on a vacant site located at 655 Frenchtown Road in East Greenwich. This is a hybrid development comprised of a 30-unit 4% LIHTC project as well as a 33-unit 9% LIHTC project, each owned by separate entities. The co-developers are Penrose LLC and Cove Homes Incorporated, an affiliate of East Greenwich Housing Authority. This request is for firm approval of 2022-2023 9% low-income housing tax credits in an amount not to exceed $545,682, a home loan, an HTF loan, an HPF loan, and an RI rebound loan for Frenchtown 1. This RFA is also seeking firm approval of tax-exempt construction financing of up to $7.5 million, an HPF loan, and an RI rebound loan for Frenchtown 2. Frenchtown 1 and 2 received preliminary approval from the board in April 2022, and preliminary approval for RI rebounds on June 16, 2022. Frenchtown 1 and 2 will serve a range of incomes, including 24 units at 30% of area median income, 2 units at 50% AMI, 30 units at 60% AMI, and 7 units at market rate. 8 of the 30% AMI units will be subsidized with Section 811 vouchers. Each tranche will also benefit from project-based vouchers administered by the East Greenwich Housing Authority. This development will assist in East Greenwich reaching their 10% affordable housing requirement. There have been several changes since preliminary approval. The number of market rate units has been reduced from 19 to 7, resulting in 12 additional LIHTC units. The distribution of units has been modified. There are now 1 and 2 bedroom units in each tranche. The developer received a federal earmark of $2 million to assist with project costs, resulting in HPF funds being returned to RI Housing. The developer was awarded 8 additional project-based vouchers from the East Greenwich Housing Authority, allowing the project to carry permanent debt on Frenchtown 2. The tax-exempt bond financing has increased from the $5.6 million to $7.5 million to meet the 50% test for Frenchtown 2. In an effort to address the increase in construction costs, the project team undertook value engineering, resulting in a reduction of $1.5 million from the development budget. The cost per unit has risen beyond the 2022 QAP cap. The cost increases can be attributed to increased financing costs and increased construction costs. The current combined CDC per unit net of reserves is $466,485, which exceeds the current cap of $429,000 by $37,485. One additional deviation is that the deal fails the second bridge loan test. However, CREA's first equity payment pay-in is $20,000 at closing.
20%.
Sorry, thank you. We are waiting on updated approvals, appraisals. Last week, the syndicator requested that the project be reallocated by square footage and not unit size. CREA has confirmed that LIHTC pricing will remain the same. We are comfortable with the LTV as presented previously. However, if the new appraisal is not at the same level or higher, it will result in a developer fee. Our construction team has evaluated the current proposed schedule of values and determined that the current pricing is consistent with pricing on other similar elevator-served buildings. Although construction costs have increased since preliminary approval, the developer is not requesting additional funds from preliminary approval. The federal earmark of $2 million will result in funds being returned to Rhode Island Housing. The investor is CREA LLC. Permanent debt of both the 9 and 4% will be financed with Cedar Rapids. Cedar Rapids will also be the construction lender on the 9%, and Rhode Island Housing will be providing the construction loan on the 4% tranche. Happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Steph. Have a motion to approve.
Sarah, I'll make a motion to
approve. Great. Thank you, Sarah. And this is Kevin. I'll second that then. Any questions with this one?
No, I don't have any questions.
Okay. Tony, thank you for being here today. Could we, I know that Stephanie said that your group reviewed the costs and you feel that they're consistent with this type of product in the market today, but could you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, there's a few unique things about this development. So it's elderly, but it also has services and providers, so it has a great number of amenity spaces that you wouldn't normally see on a project. And you alluded to something earlier, the infrastructure. It's a site that infrastructure was very difficult to get to. They have, of course, main on the site, of course, you know, more extra money. The geotechnicals are really pretty bad. You have to remove most of the soil with the foundation and all the excavation areas, and got a large underground storm drainage systems that they had to take soil out and put new soil in, and they had boulders and ledge, you know, so they had a lot of site conditions that were very difficult to deal with. We also had the escalations with COVID at this time. We're working with on this project, one of our contractors who's known for kind of being having realistic numbers. We went through the PE process with them, and we felt pretty confident his numbers were pretty consistent with what was being offered. They also are hitting very high energy efficiency standards, RMIT Kit 2. They've got solar. Solar was originally outside of the construction contract, you know, probably $300,000 worth of solar that's going on to the building. All these things they drive up the cost to some degree. And some of the things that West End 2 that you alluded to that, you know, the roof savings for, we didn't have the luxury on this deal. We had to build the amenities. We had to bring in the infrastructure that didn't exist, you know. We had a site that was pretty difficult to deal with, and the end product cost a little bit more than normal to see, but it's probably in line with all these other, you know, these extraneous circumstances.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. What's our kind of our policy stance in general on something like this with such a large cost overrun?
Mm-hmm. An exception to our policy around cost. I think they've done a great job of cost containment given what they had to work with. I think it's an excellent team, and I think they are providing us with a product that is very needed, particularly down in this community. Yeah.
Okay. Is this set any kind of precedent, you think, going forward for other applications?
This is Ann. I don't know if it's a precedent. What I would say is we do expect others, and I think we've sort of talked about this before. There have been enough, volatility and in the construction market and increases due to COVID and subsequent supply chain issues that we will be bringing additional projects to the board in the next few months that will likely also seek an exception in regard to the cost cap. You know, obviously where we can, we push as hard as we do, but, you know, Tony's team does, you know, as good a job as any across this country in making sure that we're getting what we're paying for.
You know, we were concerned when we were talking about having a per-unit cap. We knew that we were going down this road and that we were going to bump up against labor challenges, supply chain issues, and when you have a site that has, although we were able to purchase the site at a very good price, particularly in this community, there are challenges that, you know, a DOT site will have that when you go in and you start excavating, that's what you're dealing with, right?
Right.
Just one other thing.
We knew it. We knew we were going to have higher costs.
One of the things is James Comer. You know, it's also what you're buying for the money. And, you know, there is always a tension and a trade-off between if you can spend money up front to reduce the operating costs over the next 30 years, that's worthwhile. And the energy efficiency stuff that Tony was talking about, the solar, the other things that they're doing will make this a much more feasible development to operate in addition to obviously lowering the carbon footprint and being better for the environment. So, you know, we're in kind of a middle spot between that type of technology becoming so widespread that it drives the cost down. We know that it's great to use, but there's still a premium to do that up front. And so we're going to see some of those in some future deals as well.
I don't know that costs are going to come down on any of the deals that we'll see coming out of the development area. I don't know that they'll be quite at this level, but I think we're going to see more exceptions to the per unit cap than the norm.
And that's the way you think it would be best to proceed, is with exceptions versus revisiting kind of a policy?
Mm. Well, maybe let's get through this 9% round. We have 50 some odd deals through the door right now. So I think it's worthwhile having this group sit down and take a look at what's coming through.
Okay.
You know, historic properties, the costs are going to be driven.
Right.
So
right.
Let's wait and see what we have before we make a wholesale shift in the per unit.
And everyone's favorite time of the year, QAP season,
just
is just about upon us.
We're talking about the 2024 QAP, so the timing is perfect.
QAP.
Bring it to the board in June, I know.
I think, one other note, I think that both Tony and James, you hit on this, is we're getting what we're paying for. So, and obviously the Middletown deal shows that you can build for less.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we think about the type of housing that we're encouraging or we're paying for. And maybe we don't need to pay for something like this for all of our projects. Maybe we can get units for less. Maybe they're a little different somehow, different sites or different design or something or other. But I think that, I mean, we have a lot of money obviously coming in and we need to get it out.
Yeah.
I understand that, but I also just want to make sure that we keep our eyes on being as efficient as we can be.
And West House 2, this is Dean Harrison, West House 2 is able to use a lot of the public space, so they didn't have to build that into their building.
Oh, I understand. I'm not saying that can be replicated, you know, too often, but you can find a site that's, you know, doesn't have the issues like that this Frenchtown Road one does, which helps. Let me see. Oh, there was another tweak, if that was right, 42-year amortization. Is that right?
No, it's not a 42-year amortization. The term is because we close on the loan, there's 2 years of construction, and then it's 40
years. Oh, and a 40-year. Okay. I was like,
yeah.
Talk doing that, but I hadn't.
No. They, it's, okay. It's just,
We probably should clarify that next time if that's how you're reading it.
Like, ooh.
Or say
every little bit helps.
We'll be at a 60-year AM at some point, right?
4 years from completion is really what it means.
I got it. Okay. I didn't have any other questions. None. Okay.
No.
All those in favor of approving?
Aye.
Aye. The motion's approved. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see, and the final item is the recommendation for approval of transfer of physical assets for Barbara Jordan 1 apartments located in Providence. And Ann will be presenting.
Yes.
Hi, this is Ann Berman. She'll be a little simpler than the last conversation. So this RFA is the, as we've done this before, an administrative action that is required under our general rules governing the multifamily programs. This request is for approval to transfer the general partnership interest in Barbara Jordan 1, which is an affordable housing development in Providence. It consists of 193 units in, I believe, 82 separate buildings. In 2017, this development was purchased by affiliates of Omni New York and rehabbed using tax-exempt bonds and low-income housing tax credits. You may recall this was an old HUD foreclosed property with a full Section 8 contract. The principals of Omni New York are selling basically their entire portfolio, which consists of more than 180 developments, including Barbara Jordan 1, to an affiliate of Nuveen Real Estate. The limited partner in this deal is CREA, and that will not change. The current property owner is Reliant Realty Services, also an affiliate of Omni. It will be purchased by Nuveen. However, the president and senior staff at Reliant will remain, so we don't expect any change in the management agent. The transferee will assume all of the existing obligations encumbering the development, and so we were asking for approval of the following: the transfer of the general partnership interest in Barbara Jordan 1 Limited Partnership, the owner of Barbara Jordan 1 Apartments, from affiliates of Omni New York to affiliates of Nuveen Real Estate Group, subject to the conditions that were outlined in the resolution. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thanks so much, Ann. Sir, can I have a motion?
I'll make a motion.
Okay, this one. Thank you. Do you have any questions about?
Can you just go back and explain the relationship between the.
Goodbye.
Is there a relationship? This is a completely arm's length transaction between the two parties.
Okay. And Omni is just getting out of the business?
I think Omni was made an offer that they can't refuse. I read, I've never seen a purchase and sale quite as complicated as this, but I can tell you it's a substantial amount of money. The earnest deposit was actually over $100 million.
And they have projects across the country.
Most of the projects are in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic. It appears that there is a small portion of developments in New York City financed by NYCHA that they are going to retain, but I'll be honest, it's so complicated, it's a little hard to, I really focused on the Barbara Jordan 1 issue and not kind of those details.
Okay. Well, it's good to see the interest of institutional capital.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm.
It's going to lower the cost. Well, it's going to raise the price for I guess, sellers, which is good for them, but overall it should bring the cost of capital down and allow us to do more. I think that's a good thing. And Nuveen's been in the business a long time. So.
Yeah. I think they were bought. Weren't they recently purchased? Not Nuveen.
They may have been. I don't know.
Yeah, I thought they were recently.
And just, you know, I know you folks know this, but I'll mention it anyway. Because this has a HUD Section 8 contract, they have to be approved by HUD as well through a transfer. So.
Okay. I don't have any. I assume this meets all the requirements. Yeah, I don't have any other questions. So.
Okay.
Okay. Do a vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Ayes have it. That concludes our agenda items for today. We just have a pipeline discussion.
Yeah. So this is Anne again. You know, we talked about this at the last board meeting. Staff is eyeballs deep in review of applications. We've got 55 applications for production, seeking almost $220 million of various funding requests. 10 of those applications are 9% applications. 13 are 4% applications, and there's 42 that are non-LIHTC apps and include a few home ownership as well as a three ARP projects that are specific for commercial rather than residential. Staff is working their way through. We've got project summaries for all of the projects. Deficiency clarification letters are going out. They're all pretty standard. Every developer has a week to respond. We're trying to be very methodical and very consistent. I think we've sort of met internally. I think our goal is to try and, to the extent possible, maybe bring a couple in March, a few in April, and the bulk in January. In May, might slip till June. I mean, it's a lot of work. You know, we're making good progress. I think what's interesting is many of these will pass threshold. There are a few that clearly are not ready for prime time, but it's a good sign that folks, you know, we've got some good developers, a couple of one new national developer who's showing some interest. So I think it's a good cross section of developers and project types. So we're excited. I think we'll be able to bring some good projects to the board. We just have to kind of get through it. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Does it make sense to have some kind of dashboard, do you think, for all this money?
Working on it.
Okay.
Yeah, we are working on it.
Okay.
So it's just how you design it and how the information rolls up.
Yeah.
Something like rent relief, probably not as complicated, but staff is working.
I think just something to show that, yeah, this has been allocated, this is left, and, you know, nothing. Yeah.
Yep. I mean, James, Amy, and I have been doing a lot of getting out and talking about what this looks like. There's another meeting with the EPA coming up, so to the extent we can message it and get the word out. So it's not about, well, funds aren't being, you know, deployed. Funds are being deployed.
Right.
It's just...
Right. Right.
You're right. The message has to be more widespread. So we're working on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Great. And have you seen any, I don't know, any issues or trends in these applications or any concerns or anything?
Some of these, I will say that the tax credit deals are expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Often, you know, you talked about sort of the site. I don't know what it is about tax credit developers, but they seem to gravitate to difficult sites. And it doesn't matter if they're for-profits or exactly, or nonprofits.
Dreams, maybe.
Yeah. you know, and sometimes they're, you know, some of the ones that are in urban areas, really tight sites. There, you know, there's not a lot of land in some of the communities that we're trying to develop in. There are old buildings. They're trying to modify old buildings. Those are the only opportunities. So I do think we're going to be revisiting that cost issue. I think the other thing that's interesting is we had a more than I expected number of developments from developers who have not worked with us before, but see an opportunity to do 80% affordable units without tax credits as part of a larger market rate development. And, you know, these are large developments. I'm talking about 200 or 300 units. And so with 20% of them set aside at 80%, I think there's a real opportunity to have a significant impact for a very reasonable per unit expense. So I think that that's the good news.
And weaving into mixed income and maybe somebody else looking over their shoulder.
Right. I know a couple of them are in communities that haven't hit their 10%. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Any concerns about capacity with general contractors or architects or any?
Tony Bond. There is definitely a shortage of contractors and workers in the state. And so I think that's probably part of this course discussion, not just the sites that folks are picking or that are available. Most of the sites I look at are affected by environmental issues, you know, ledge, boulders, unsuitable soil, these kind of things, and with the lack of contractors. It's probably gonna, we're probably going to have this discussion for a while.
I know that sometimes, you know, a sub down in Middletown doesn't want to come all the way up to Providence. issues like that.
Do you think we
need to be looking farther afield to try to bring more in? Is that something that we should be taking on? Or?
I think we've been trying to encourage, we dropped our percentage of out-of-state contractor requirements down to 50 now. You know, we know it's just a shortage of subcontractors. There's a lot of GCs are getting contractors from others out-of-state. That's one of the things going on. But there's a lot of groups out there that are starting to think hard about trying to bring workers into the trades, with a lack of losing workers in the trades, and bringing, you know, up. Building the capacity of a lot of these subs is in the future, tomorrow, you know?
Right.
But that's sort of a long-term thing. I'm actually sitting on a board now that kind of that's what they're targeting, you know, but something is a discussion. I think everyone in the construction industry is feeling it,
Yeah.
One of the things that arose to, this is James Comer, out of our strategic planning process was this exact question, is that there is, as Tony says, a labor shortage and a shortage of qualified contractors in the state. And Tony's actually leading a group that is kind of addressing not only that general issue, but the issue in, of creating contract capacity in communities of color. And so we will be putting out an RFP in the next few weeks to solicit opportunities for training to... it's out. There you go. It's out. It's on the street to solicit opportunities for training to that we can sponsor for folks to come in and get folks... As Tony said, sometimes it's getting people trained in the skills to participate in the workforce. Sometimes it's contractor capacity training to help folks build their capacity and grow to be able to take on more more elaborate jobs as they move along. So,
Tony, about just one thing I'd like to add to that. So the designers that you do, yes, there is a shortage, and there are a lot of developers are waiting for, you know, the engineers or their surveyors or their architects. Mm-hmm. So many architects and engineering firms are on, and a lot of work.
Yeah.
This is Dean Harrison. We're finding out with some of the nonprofit partners also having capacity issues now. You know, they got few to four deals in the pipeline, you know, and to get these over the finish line on top of trying to put an application in, we've noticed that's caused somewhat of a slowdown too.
Yeah.
Getting these deals over the finish line.
Okay.
And just to pour it on, right? You think about it, this is Rhode Island, right? Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Hampshire, they all have the same big pots of money, so are going through the same challenge, right? So if you're working in Southeast Massachusetts, you don't need to come to Rhode Island because you've got plenty of work. So, but we'll figure it out.
Right. Good. All right. Any other questions or comments? No. Motion to adjourn. All right. Seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Great. Thank you.